Yes, please, shut the doors, Kennedy. So we don't have sound from the road outside. So, who remembers where we left off in class? First Peter 3, right? We skipped husbands and wives, right? Okay. And that wasn't because I was afraid to tackle it, because I'm going to tackle it tonight, right? But because I wanted to get to the portion that's right after that, right? Which is something that hits me, right, in a very serious way. So I wanted to go ahead and deal with that, because I didn't know whether VR was going to be back tonight or not. Obviously, he's not. He's still at home. He's still contagious. The doctors have not given him the go-ahead yet to come back to worship. Yeah, well, the doctors have said you have to stay home still. So whether he's still contagious or not, the doctors are... Batteries here are active. And if, well, that's this, right? I'm placing the ones here in the power pack right now. Nope, they're gone too. These are long gone. Okay. Well, I hate being tied down. Okay. One moment. I'm just going to stay up here tonight. Yeah, it should still be picking up. If you want to go check on the audio stream, that's fine. But it should still be picking up. I guess I'm stuck to the lectern tonight unless somebody want to. Well, anyway, so we covered verses 8 through 17 of chapter 3 last week, right? Just because I wanted to go ahead and skip ahead to that because I wanted to cover it. VR is obviously not doing well. So we're going to go back. We're going to cover husbands and wives, which we did not cover last week. So buckle up. This is where it gets fun. So going back to the grace of submission, right? Peter starts off with civil authority, right? Then he goes into socioeconomic authority structures in the Roman society, and we sort of talked about that last week, so we're not going to rehash that again. But now he talks about another authority structure, husbands and wives. So he starts off, and just to get a few things out of the way, how many verses are written toward wives? In chapter 3. How many verses are written toward husbands? Okay, that's a nice ratio, right? I kid. I couldn't help that. But he's gone into what he's doing right now is he's narrowing the focus, right? He starts in really like as broad as you can get as far as society is concerned. And then he narrows it down, right, to your sort of immediate sphere. And then he narrows it down even further into the home, right? And so the focus is getting smaller and smaller as we go through this. So what does he say to wives? You guys talking about this in the ladies' Bible class? I'm just kidding. I know what you talk about. At least in a general term. She doesn't give me all the details. So what does he say, Pat? Okay, be subject to your own husbands. Right. Why? What's the point? I mean, first of all, you do it because God says to do it. Can I get an amen, brothers? But why? What specific purpose does Peter have in mind here? So if your husband's not a Christian, right? Right.
So if women were married to people who weren't Christians, they had a conflict there.
Yeah. And all of this is about religious conflict. Right? And Madison's bringing up a great point. You know, everybody in the family was expected to worship the gods that the father worshipped, right? That the patriarch worshipped, right? Which is why you see certain things happening in the New Testament, right? When the Philippian jailer is baptized, who else is baptized?
His whole household.
And so what does that mean, his whole household? Because remember, he's an officer. Right, his personal staff. His wife, his adult children, right? But also his household staff, right? Cornelius, when Cornelius is baptized, what happens? Same thing, right? So, you find that pattern set, and Madison's bringing up a really great point, that, you know, it's nice when that swings in the favor of Jesus, right? But on the other hand, there are moments in which, you know, if you belong to a household where the patriarch does not call upon the name of Jesus, then you've got a difficult choice to make, right? You buck the system, or you deny your Lord. Which one's it going to be, right? And Peter's saying, well, we buck the system, okay? This is the first time where Peter, in the whole concept of submission here, actually says, you know, you submit to your husband, but only insofar as you actually can, right? Which is something that's sort of been subliminally true throughout, you know, the first section and the second section, but now he gets pretty clear about it, right? You submit to your husband, right? But if he's not a believer, you know, you can't worship his gods, right? That's not going to fly. That doesn't work. But, you know, again, all this is, you know, keep in mind, what was Nero saying about Christians? What were the accusations? Okay, they're against Caesar, okay? What accusations were made about Paul in Ephesus? These men have turned the world upside down, okay? That they are agents of chaos, that their religious practices run contrary to Roman tradition, their way of lifestyle is contrary to Roman values, right? And so when Peter says to people, submit to Caesar, right? You know, you even when you're submitting as you're being killed for your faith, you're in a way proving yourself to be more Roman than Romans actually are. Because, you know, Romans value order, they value structure, right? And so the basic rule of thumb in Roman society is, you know, maintain the status quo, right? Maintain the status quo. Unless you think you can get away with it. Honor Caesar, obey him at all costs. Unless you think you can replace him. Right? I mean, how full is Roman history of different men seizing the imperial throne? Right? By the way, we have this phrase in English, crossing the Rubicon. What does that mean in English? What does that mean? What's the meaning of that idiom? Means you've crossed the point of no return, right? You've fully committed yourself. By the way, how many people have heard that phrase before? Okay. Pete, thank you. We're not the only two. So the reason that phrase has persisted in English is because the Rubicon was one of the boundaries of the city of Rome. And that Roman soldiers, the only Roman soldiers in the entire army that were allowed within the confines of the city of Rome itself were the Praetorian Guard. Unless there was a triumph going on. And then the general's army who was being honored was allowed to parade through the streets. But when the day of triumph was over, they had to go back outside the city. So they're only allowed inside on that one day, and that's it. They don't get to come back in. So if you're a general and you take your army and you cross the Rubicon River, you're seizing the throne. You're attempting to, right? And once you do that, there is no going back. You either succeed or you die trying, because you've taken soldiers inside Rome, which means you got to fight and you got to win. So our phrase, the phrase in English, crossing the Rubicon, has persisted to this day. It's not, you don't find it as used as commonly as it used to be used, but it's still there. And so when people submit, even as they're being killed or mistreated like slaves being abused by their masters, they're actually proving themselves to be more Roman than Romans are. That they actually uphold the values at the most dire moments that Rome espouses with their mouths. And so, again, in this context, here's where things start to shift a little bit with wives and husbands. You don't submit to his gods. And the whole point is, you know, what's the end result that Peter's talking, that Peter's aiming at, right? Right, that you don't... Your behavior, right? So, the goal is conversion. Right? That's the goal. You submit to your husband insofar as it, in all ways in which it is possible. Because they should look at you and look at the fact that, you know, you're a Christian, but you aren't crazy. You're not turning the world upside down. You're not disrupting the family order. You're not seeking to overthrow the patriarchy and install a matriarchy. Right? That's not what's going on. You're not seeking to rebel against the entire Roman system. You're just saying, I'm not going to worship those gods because I've got the one true God. Right? And that's the whole idea behind this. But there are some other things that go on along with this. Right? You know, in addition to this whole religious conflict aspect of it that loads the first two verses, or the first two verses, right? When they see your respectful and pure conduct, right? Then he talks about some other things. So what does he say right after that? Don't. And here's where it gets interesting. It says, don't let your adorning be external. There's an implication in the language. It's kind of hard because you have to, like, sometimes Greek says something and it implies a word that's not there. And in Greek, it's understood that the implication is, you know, this word is here even if it's not actually here. And they do that actually a lot with certain things. And this is one of the ways that they do it. The word that isn't here that kind of belongs here is just or simply. I think the NIV actually straight up translates it, do not let your adorning be merely external. Anybody have the NIV? Okay, is that what it says in verse 3? Okay. So, not the translation I was thinking of. But there is one translation that says, do not let your adorning be merely external, right? Which is true because, let's face it, is there a single woman on the planet who's just going to get up and throw sackcloth on and walk out the door? No. No. Right? But the point is an overemphasis on the outside, right? That, you know, one of the things that's interesting is that Peter's kind of making a dig at Rome itself here. Because on the outside, Rome looks great, doesn't it? I mean, it's got the best science and engineering of its day, hands down, without question. They had indoor heated plumbing and underwater sewer systems. They had, you know, all kinds of really cool technological stuff going on. The city was clean, it was bright, it was beautiful, it was huge, it was spread out. You know, their construction has lasted for a couple thousand years. I mean, the only reason the Colosseum is in ruins, quite frankly, right, aside from the wooden portions which are going to decay and rot over time, right? But, you know, you see the Colosseum, pictures of the Colosseum, and it's in ruins, right? Okay, the only reason the Colosseum is in ruins is because people have taken the building stones, or the molded concrete stones away from the Colosseum and used them in other buildings around the city. If none of the stones had been taken away, all of the concrete that was there 2,000 years ago would still be there. And these guys built to last. And there's something majestic about that. But if you look on the inside of Rome, it's not as pretty as it seems. The economic system of the empire was built around conquest. That the budget of the empire couldn't be sustained without conquering and enslaving other people. So that's why there were always wars to expand the borders of the empire, because if there wasn't, the empire would collapse. And as soon as the conquest stopped, what happened? The empire economically collapsed in the West. And as soon as, you know, the people that they hired to do their conquest for them turned on them, and, you know, just legends are born. The Dark Ages fell, right? Although Rome still continued to be Rome in the East, but that's a matter for history. But he's saying the primary adornment is in the outside, right? What should we be spending the most time on making sure? And by the way, this isn't just true for women. This is also true for men, right? This sort of blanket principle. I mean, what should we be spending the most time making sure that it looks good? Yes. Our soul, right? Our soul. Make sure that looks good first, right? Because, you know, some of us, no matter what we do, the outside is never going to look good. Not talking about anyone here. Just saying. Make sure the inside looks good first, right? And then he says, you know, this is sort of an interesting thing. He says it's very precious in God's sight. Why would he use the word precious? By the way, where else does he use the word precious? In 1 Peter? Where does Peter use it? Precious promises? Okay. I spent like 3 weeks doing background for one section of text. Chapter 2. The cornerstone is very precious in the sight of God. And there's something there, right? The connection between wives and Jesus, right, in this moment. Because Jesus was rejected by the society of his day because he didn't fit the mold, right? So they didn't know what to do with him, so they threw him away. But God says he's precious, right? And that we have become precious to God when society rejects us. And you connect that with what Peter is saying here to wives in chapter 3. This is an important message because, you know, keep in mind the cultural context of the day. Keep in mind the anthropology of the Roman Empire, right? Women, how much say do they have? Not much, right? Not much at all. Like, the only say you got was the say your husband let you have, and that was only if your family was really, really rich and well-connected, right? If your husband married you because he was marrying up, then you might have some say, but you only got a little. Only a little. And that was as much say as you ever got. Only a little, and only in that situation. Only if both your families are really rich and your husband's marrying up. That's the only time you ever get a say in anything. But more often than not, you don't get a say. Your dad gets a say. And he gets to tell your husband what to do. So you still don't get much of a say. So this whole issue with female cultural identity in the Roman Empire is something that Peter's dealing with right now. And it's something that is designed to be very empowering for Christian women in the context of their society. Because you've got here this social structure in which women have, you know, only what they're allowed to have, only what their men deign to give them. And here Peter is, the prophet, the apostle, is telling you, it doesn't matter what the men in your life say, God says you're precious. And God values you. And that's an intrinsic part of this message here that we shouldn't neglect or overlook or go past. Because if you look at history, one of the things that early historians, early church religious historians record is that, you know, a lot of the Christian assemblies, especially early on, were comprised of two groups of people: slaves and women. Slaves and women. There's a reason for that, right? And you look at all the people that God has embraced throughout his relationship with humanity, right? And he's always taken in the outcasts, the downtrodden, the people who society rejects. I mean, you know, there's no greater example of this, at least in my mind, of course, aside from Jesus himself, than Jephthah from the book of Judges. I mean, just walk through Jephthah's history. And he's a person who is just flat out designed by, you know, it's like, if you could tailor a person that the society of his day would reject, it's Jephthah. Because he's the son of a prostitute, right? And then he gets kicked out by his half-brothers because they don't want him to inherit from their dad's property and riches. And so he has to go live as a vagabond. He becomes a mercenary, fights for money, owes allegiance to no gods and no country. Spills blood for gold. And then he ends up leading his own mercenary band. So, you know, now he's not just a mercenary, he's a mercenary captain, which means, you know, now he's the real jerk that you actually have to deal with when you negotiate. But all of a sudden, when the tribes of Gilead are having trouble, who do they come to? Well, they come to Jephthah. And I'm not going to get into preaching a lesson about Jephthah right now, but Peter makes this point for a reason, right? The things that humans reject, God tends to value, which is essentially what Paul says, right? When he calls the things that this world has called wise, God calls what? Foolish, right? This is 1 Corinthians 1 and 1 Corinthians 3, right? The things that this world calls foolish, God has chosen to call wise, right? And so here, again, we find the same thing. And so who does Peter hold up as an example of this kind of behavior? Of to humble the mighty. Right, yeah, he's chosen the night like medicine, again, from 1 Corinthians. He's chosen the weak things of the world to humble the strong. So who does Peter hold up as an example of how to think about your husband? Sarah. What's interesting about this example? Okay, so she laughs, all right? So it's not you have to be in, like, you know, it's funny because, you know, God, Peter picks a moment where Sarah laughs, right? But there's something else going on here, too. Amen. Sarah obeyed Abraham, and she called him Lord. Now, the word Lord here is the word kurios, which is also the word that is used for Jesus the Lord, right? It's roughly equivalent to the Hebrew word Adonai, right? In Hebrew, there's actually no word for husband per se. There's not a word. There's a word for wife, but there's not a word for husband. Because your husband is your Lord. That's the word for husband. Maybe we should speak Hebrew. Just these are, that was a joke, Senator. But, you know, the interesting thing about this is when Peter holds this up as an example, the other thing that's fascinating about this, you know, you go back to Genesis 18, right? Genesis 17 and 18, that's where this example is from, right? Peter says she obeyed her husband, she called him Lord, right? Okay, in what circumstance does Sarah ever call Abraham Lord? How many times does she do it in the book of Genesis? Once and only once that I can remember. That's the moment Peter is referring to. When God is promising the birth of Isaac. Sarah says, after I am old and worn out, that's to talk about honest self-assessment, right? Shall I and my Lord have pleasure in our old age? But if you go back to Genesis, the thing about that is that she never actually says that out loud. But the point is, she never says this out loud. She never actually says it out loud, because if you go back to the text, she's thinking it internally to herself. And that's when God calls her on it and says, why'd you laugh? Because she didn't laugh out loud either, right? It was an internal incredulity at the statement. And God's like, why'd you laugh? Because she's eavesdropping, right? She's eavesdropping on the other side of the tent barrier, right? And then, you know, God says, why'd you laugh? And she's like, she spoils, she's like, Sarah would not make a good hide-and-seek player, okay? I didn't laugh! Yeah, you did. Just go ahead and come on in, because we know you're there now. Why'd you laugh? Well, I didn't laugh. You know, with God, with men, some things are impossible. With God, all things are possible. And so, you know, he promises Isaac, you know, a year from then. But that whole moment right there where she laughs and she says, after I am old and worn out, shall I and my Lord have pleasure in our old age? All of that is happening as an internal monologue right there. She never actually says it out loud, which is sort of another interesting point. And here's where I just got to be honest and lay it down. Even if you don't talk to your husband this way, you should still think about your husband this way. And that's true for every Christian woman. That's just the way it is. That's what the text says, right? It's right there. Even if you never, because, you know, whenever I preach this text, I totally steal from something that I heard Don say once, Don Wilson. He said, you know, most times, you know, for almost every single man on the planet, the only time he's ever going to hear the word Lord out of his wife's mouth is when she says, oh, Lord. But the point is, even if you don't address your husband that way, you should still think of him that way. Because that's what Scripture says. Yeah? Yeah. Right. I see what you're doing there, Judy. Okay, so the thing is, the immediate context is Roman society. That's absolutely true. But the principles still hold true for us, right? Because there are certain things in the immediate context that are very obviously Roman, right? But the principles that drive and bind all of them apply to all societies everywhere. To establish that, right, the paradigm itself between husbands and wives, you know, Paul writes this in Ephesians chapter 5, right? But it's not phrased in the context of Roman society at all. Like, Peter is very intrinsically just rooted and grounded in that because he's in Rome when he writes it, right? But Paul's not, right? Paul's writing Ephesians like in a totally different background to a totally different group of people, and you know, there may not be there, and it doesn't seem like there is at all any immediate context of Roman society, other than the fact that, you know, that's just the society that it that they're living in when it's written. Peter has some things that are sort of very obviously about that, right? But even though that is absolutely true, right, about what Peter is saying, that the immediate context is very much Roman, the principles are true nonetheless, regardless of whatever society we're living in at the time. The whole concept of women being precious and not getting a say, I mean, that's not, that doesn't just happen in Rome. Think about societies in our day that are still built that way. We've got friends who live and work in the Middle East. And what women have to go through in Saudi Arabia, for example, is absolutely horrific, right? I mean, you're not allowed to walk around alone without a male guardian, right? You have to have a male companion who's a relative with you, or else, you know, you're breaking the law. Like, only recently has the Saudi government considered allowing women to drive. And I'm promise I won't make any jokes. You know, this isn't just true for Rome. This is true for everybody. Yeah. Right, right. Right, and you know, this whole issue like of being precious, right? I talked about the Roman structure to sort of set the immediate context, but that applies to, I mean, think about how many women are in abusive relationships. This whole concept of being precious applies to them too. And Judy's right, you know, and the point she's making is that, you know, all of it applies to us. That's absolutely correct. You know, that applies to them too. And that's something that's hard to think about, because we don't like to think about it, right? But that's true. You know, there are a myriad of ways in which we could take a look at these principles and say, look at how it's real for us. And you know, that's Judy's right. That's an absolutely fair point, right? All these things are for us, right? Although I did, you know, keep everything in the immediate Roman context, you know, I was, you know, that's obvious. That I hope that was, you know, obvious as the intent, the principles of drive and apply to all of us, to all marriages, relationships from here on out. And, you know, this whole issue about, you know, having a wife who's a Christian and a husband who's not, you know, we got Pat. Yeah, we got mom, right? My family, right? You know, Ed's in the reverse scenario. You know, he is, but, you know, his wife remains Catholic. That's hard. It's a hard life, right? And you know, the thing about, like, this section of 1 Peter is that, you know, the whole grace of submission part is you do what's right no matter what, right? No matter what the other person does. It doesn't get any harder than a marriage. Doing what's right, if the other person doesn't do what's right, it's never harder than it is in a marriage. Elmer, you had your hand up. Hidden person of the heart. Yeah. Yeah, some people. Yeah, some people tattoo makeup on because they don't want to have to put it on every morning to save time. But, you know, it's you know, Elmore's right. You know, it's a, this is about what matters, right? It's about what matters the most. Charles? You know, right. Mm-hmm. What about the mirror that James mentions? Exactly. Comment of the night goes to Charles Williamson. As I said, comment of the night goes to Charles Williamson. I'll be sleeping on the couch. Brother Charles is absolutely right. You know, put the same amount of time, effort, and pain into the inside that people often do on the outside. Like, you know, women, I will never understand high heels. Okay? And then women say, well, beauty is pain. I'm like, I don't know. Glad men aren't expected to wear high heels. But unless they're Prince. but, you know, it's Charles is right. You know, how much time and effort are we willing to put on the inside?
Yeah. Well, especially
right. We have buildings that are temples to pain, where people walk in. And there are mirrors all over the place so you can look at how terrible you look. And they go in and they inflict upon themselves an excruciating pain all in the name of looking better. I myself happen to think round is an incredibly useful shape. But, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, look at how societies in general, and if you examine beauty standards throughout history, you know, one of the fascinating things is how they shift and change and evolve. But the other thing that's fascinating is the lengths to which people will go to adhere to whatever the beauty standards of their day are. Right? Well, what about God's beauty standard? Right? And again, this is true for males and females. Right? This isn't just for wives. Right? You know, James talks about this and applies it to everybody. Right? Looking into the law, the perfect law of liberty. Right? You know, like Charles said, you know, what about, in my comment, to his comment, what about God's mirror? So I want to go to the husbands now. Appropriately, we're going to spend about 5 minutes on the husbands. But, in an interesting way, Peter spends one verse on the husbands. But what he says here is weightier than the 6 verses that he spends on wives. He says, likewise, husbands, first of all, so, you know, godly wives submit to the authority of their husbands, right? That's the first 6 verses of chapter 3. So, verse 7, godly husbands empower their wives to live in holiness by righteous shepherding. Because godly authority doesn't subject, it empowers. And it empowers to holiness. And that's the whole goal behind being a righteous husband, is to help your family be more holy. Likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. And here's the instruction, okay? Again, ground it immediately in the Roman context and then bring it forward to today, right? Roman context. Women don't inherit anything. The only inheritance women get is what their husbands get from his father. Women don't inherit anything. Yet here, Peter is saying women inherit just as much as their husbands. And it's husbands that need to learn that lesson. Your wife is just as much an heir of God as you are. I'll get to Elmore in just 1 second. I want to finish this thought real quick. In a society that knew nothing about equality, equality is what's being taught in this verse. God loves your wife just as much as he loves you. God values your wife just as much as he values you. God will give your wife for her own sake just as much as he will give you. Do not disrespect what God values. Do not neglect that. Do not think lightly of it. Because if you disrespect what God values, what's going to happen? What's the end of the verse? God will not listen to your prayers. And again, put it in the Roman model. The husband prayed for the whole family in the Roman tradition, right? The husband goes to pray before the family altar with the gods that the family worships. The husband is the one who prays. If you put it in that context, the entire family's conduit to God is now shut off. And so you're hurting not just yourself, but everybody. Right, again, it's like to the societal structure, right? Of course, we know women can pray all on their own, right? And God will listen to them just as much as he listens to his male disciples. But again, in the Roman societal structure, the way a Roman might tend to think, if he's not educated in the subtleties of biblical theology, we'll just call it like that, there are serious implications. But even if you do sort of understand that there's serious implications for yourself, God's not going to listen to your prayers. That's heavy. Elmore, do you have your hand up?
The word is saying here, that verse 7 says, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel. On Genesis 1:27, it says, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. And Galatians 4:27 says, for as many of you as were baptized into Christ and put on Christ, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is no male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus.
Yeah, absolutely. Galatians 3:27, right? 3:27. Yeah. 4? Or is it 3? 3:27. I thought it was 3:27. Yeah, and you know, speaking to what Elmore said about the creation narrative in Genesis, if you go back to the Septuagint in Greek, just linguistic note, nerd alert, there's two words that are translated man in Greek, right? One is a word that doesn't have anything to do with gender at all. It's a word that means a human being, right? It's the word anthropos, from which you get misanthropic or anthropomorphism or anthropology. It's a word that means a human being. The other word is aner, which means a male person, a male, right? Someone who is biologically male, who has male sex organs, right? That's the definition of aner, right? But anthropos means a person, a human being in general. So when you find that verse in Genesis chapter 1, about from the creation narrative, in the Septuagint it says, God created anthropos, aner and gune, he created them, right? Male and female. And that God created anthropoi, anthropos, the plural accusative in his image, right? So it's humanity that is created in the image of God, not just the male, right? And that's sort of another interesting point linguistically in the Septuagint. But, remember, the weight behind this is if you disrespect what God values, he will not listen to you. And so that's where we're going to close tonight. So, next week, we'll pick up with verses 18. Madison. Dude, we're out of time. I'm sorry. It was organic. I didn't intentionally skip it. We'll pick up verses 18 to the end of the chapter. Hopefully, Brother VR will be well by then, but if not, I'll be teaching class in his absence, as tonight and last week. And let's continue to pray for him. We'll have just a couple minutes break. And Brother Kennedy, where is Kennedy? There you are. I knew you were here. Would you pick out a song for us, please?